This is PC Gamer Podcast 357 for July 12th, 2013. I'm your host, Executive Editor Evan Lotti, and joining me today, Managing Editor Corey Banks.
Hey, Evan.
Hey, Corey. Welcome back from Boston, the Boston area.
Yeah, out on vacation, going out and seeing some friends and playing a bunch of board games and talking about games a lot. Now here I am talking about games with you guys.
Oh, good.
So,
after being stuck in a regrettable travel escapade.
Exactly. And you know what saved me in that travel escapade? I don't want to jump too deeply into this, but XCOM on the iPad.
Oh, hey.
Was so great. I couldn't play any games on my laptop.
I've heard that's good, but like it drains your battery. It's very significant.
Yeah, a little bit. It was worth it, though.
Cool.
It was worth it. There's some Sectoids had to die, so I took care of that. Care of business.
If you're going
to
own an iPad, having XCOM on it is a pretty good balance. That's good. All right, it makes up for it. And along with us today, with Corey and I today, are our three interns, TJ Hafer.
Hello.
Ben Kim.
Hello.
Jake Godin.
Hello.
Ben Bott. I don't know if you got the memo.
I'd just like to note that you both completely just copied my greeting.
We did in different octaves.
Just throwing a hey.
Are you guys working on like a barbershop harmony?
Hello.
Hello.
I should have gone higher. I could probably probably the only one that can do
this. Am I correct in thinking that it's not summer anymore? Is it spring right now?
Is it
still summer?
Okay. It's summer. Yeah.
I forget when the solstice is.
The solstice is
June 21st.
Thank you. Okay, so it's still summer. That's good to know, because the Steam Summer Sale is happening.
Yeah.
Started today.
It was a pro transition.
Running until July 21st. Val would have been very embarrassed if it wasn't actually summer. I would be too.
Summer Sale.
So check it out if you haven't already. Everything's going to be... we're sort of hesitating to say what's on sale right now because it's changing daily.
Yeah. But by the time you're listening to this, there are going to be different options on sale. You're basically going to have to check every single day to find whether the games that you want are on sale or add them to your wish list. And Valve says that they'll send out emails to people.
It's quite a manipulative scheme.
Absolutely. My wallet already hurt. I haven't spent anything yet, and my wallet is like aching in pain. So
indeed,
hopefully it picks up.
We did want to sort of take a moment to say, hey, if you're going to buy something, we'd recommend keeping an eye on this going on sale. And for me, that's Borderlands 2. I just think in terms of a single player and cooperative shooter, it represents kind of the best value in terms of the amount of time you get, the quality of the game it is, just the amount of content you get for whatever price it ends up being is always going to be worth it. The DLC will hopefully go on sale as well. And the fourth piece of DLC, Tiny Tina's sort of parody riff on Dungeons and Dragons, is incredible. Get that. It's the most recent one.
I wouldn't be surprised to see like a DLC bundle get included. Mm-hmm. And also, Borderlands 2 is the kind of game on Steam that will lend itself to a deep discount, right? There'll be a big four-pack that you can buy with your friends, and then all of you will be able to jump into the game and play it for a really low price.
Yeah. Cool, but for the rest of you guys, what's something you would recommend folks keep an eye on or pick up at a maybe a lower price than they normally would?
Well, Corey was talking about playing XCOM on the iPad. If you haven't played it on the PC yet, that's definitely one I would keep an eye out for.
Yeah.
That's a very... I've actually been talking to some people about maybe playing XCOM multiplayer again, which... I recall was quite fun when we were playing it in the office.
A little buggy, too. But yeah.
A little bit, but yeah. That's just a fantastic experience, and I have a feeling in my bones that there's going to be some kind of a big expansion for that announced fairly soon.
Yeah, now that they're done with Brave New World. Not that it's necessarily the same team at Frax working on both games.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good opportunity to tease our upcoming Top 100 Games of All Time feature, which is our next cover story.
Yes.
If you're a subscriber, you should be seeing that soon. And XCOM Enemy Unknown is pretty high up there. Interestingly high up there, I think.
Yeah.
Deservingly so.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we all have a lot of affection for that game.
Right.
But anyway, back to the Steam sale. What should you guys encourage people to pick up?
What will Ben Bott buy?
Keep an eye on. Yes.
Ben Bott buys.
I would say you should get Civ 5 if you don't have it already for some reason. And Brave New World with that. Hopefully it'll go on sale.
That's a question, right? Will Brave New World go on sale so quickly after release?
It might last week.
Wait, it was this week.
It might go on like one of those flash sales that last for like 4 hours for like, you know, 20 to 30% off, but I would be surprised to see it for more than that.
Right. Yeah. I think what you'll do is you'll pick up the Game of the Year edition of Civ 5 now, and you'll play a couple hours of that and go, oh my god, this is really good, what else can I buy for it? And Brave New World, TJ, you actually, you've played a lot of Brave New World already, right?
Yes, I reviewed it actually, and you can check out my review on the website. But yeah, I've played quite a bit of it. It really, I mean, I've keep saying the same thing every time anyone asks me to talk about it, but it really rounds out the end game, makes the victory types other than military actually fun instead of just kind of waiting around.
Huge changes to cultural, right?
Yeah, the cultural victory is kind of like Pokemon now, where you have to send out archaeologists to find artifacts in the world and trade them with the other civs so that you get the right combination of them to get the biggest bonuses.
It's awesome. And
even Vanilla Civ, like, if they release Vanilla Civ 5 and it's like, what, $5, maybe $10, you're still getting such an amazing game at that point. Yeah.
Or even Game of the Year. I bet you'll be able to pick up Game of the Year for like $30 or less.
Or it might even it's less way than less than that.
I bet maybe $20. I'm going to say $20 for, and that's Civ 5, Gods and Kings, all the little DLCs, Denmark, Korea, Spain, the Explorers pack, which adds some new map types.
Plus, don't forget mods.
We've got a good list that Tyler worked up on our website.
Right.
From about a month ago or so, the best Civ mods, I think 15 best.
Right. Right.
Some worthy ones in there.
Civ 5 is a good pick.
It is.
Yeah. Nice job, Benzon. Well done.
We've been playing in the office a lot in the world, so.
Three-way multiplayer.
Yep.
Winning.
What would you pick, Jake?
I was thinking maybe another grand strategy game, kind of like Crusader Kings, because it has a lot of extra content that will probably come with it on sale. So something big like that, maybe, if it goes on sale for pretty cheap, or maybe a lot of like smaller games like Hotline Miami would be an awesome investment and it would probably get pretty darn cheap.
I think that's $2.50 right now as we record this.
Exactly.
It's $2.50, which is a ridiculous amount to pay for such a good game.
Yeah, you should buy that.
Right. Have you guys bought anything already?
No.
Okay.
I can't afford to.
I bought Dark Souls for $15.
Is it already on sale?
There's a lot of stuff that is just perpetually on sale for 33 to 50% off for the duration of the Steam sale.
But you're not playing the meta game, which is like, you gotta wait for that moment.
I'm sure it'll go
30
like six,
seconds when it's 74% off or something.
I know.
Like that.
That's what I told you. I couldn't wait. I wanted to die too bad.
This makes me happy. I'm so glad you're buying Dark Souls. I'm gonna lead a master's course in, well, an apprentice course in Dark Souls. I'm excited about this. Yeah. I would pick, I'd probably go on the small end too. There are some perennial games that I think of on Steam sales that, you know, I picked them up because they were so cheap and got a ton of enjoyment out of them. Things like Mountain Blade, which I don't know if I'd ever played full price, if I'd played it a lot.
Yeah.
But that's a game that you always see go on sale. I'd want to play that a lot. I think if I were going to pick like a big AAA mainstream game to keep an eye out for, it would, and something that I've played this year that I really loved that people waiting on a sale should definitely pick up would be Tomb Raider, which has a great, I wasn't into the multiplayer experience, but the single player is a lot of fun, and I could see that game going for $15.
How long is Tomb Raider?
I spent 19 hours in it.
Oh, wow.
Okay. It was right along the same amount of time that I spent on BioShock Infinite.
Mm-hmm. Which is $30 today.
$30 today. I expect that if you miss that today, I expect you'll see that on sale later on, especially when they do the big roundup sale. But Tomb Raider is the one that I would definitely recommend.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All right, guys, thanks for your picks. So we talked about Civ 5 Brave New World, which released on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Another little game released on Tuesday, Dota 2, coming out of beta.
Kind of,
Haven't heard of it. Is that...
What? Dota?
Emerge.
Is that like a puzzle game?
Yes.
Oh.
It's an acronym.
Way to go, Valve. Nice job. Didn't have any of those before.
Terrific. So, yeah, finally out of beta after about a year and a half or 2 years, depending on when you start counting that date. And, yeah, I mean, who among us is planning to get into Dota 2 now that it's emerged from beta?
Some of us already are, aren't we?
Yeah
I've started crossing over into Dota 2 after playing a lot of League. And
how does it feel?
It feels... difficult and scary.
It has a really big learning curve. Like, okay, so I'm not the MOBA guy, but I've played a little, not nearly as much League as you have, but I've played a little bit, and I tried to jump into my first Dota 2 game right before they launched, right? And I was lost. Mm-hmm. Like, the tutorial is really well done, and I understand basic concepts for MOBAs, but it was a really embarrassing experience for me.
They don't care about accessibility at all, so
no.
If you want an easy... fun, chill experience. Probably don't want to go to Dota right away. Maybe try some other MOBA games first. But
I mean, how would you suggest people like start to learn, especially if they played some League of Legends? How would you suggest people learn to play Dota 2?
I have a comparison guide up on our site. It came out yesterday.
Yeah.
And goes over some of the differences and similarities between the two games. But I'd say for any MOBA game, you want to just play bot games with your friends until you have an understanding of what's happening. Because there's a lot of stuff that you need to learn and understand and think about at the same time, and it sort of like builds up on you. It gets really confusing.
I was gonna say, I've never, having not played Dota, but having played plenty of League, I think to jump into a new MOBA, you'd have to go in with a bunch of friends, because I think, you know, MOBA genre games tend to have like kind of a toxic community. So if you get like just shouted at and, you know, for your first game in Dota 2.
Unless you're okay with that.
Maybe. Yeah, you might be. You might be into that kind of thing. But if you're not and you want to, like, jump in with friends, it's a good kind of secure way to ensure that if you're going to suck, you're going to suck with other people. Or, you know, maybe you have friends who are really good and they can teach you at the same time.
Does your guide, Ben, does it talk about, like, starting characters, like, good places to begin? There are, like, 130 characters in Dota 2 already, right?
It's more of like a really simple but sort of comprehensive overlook of the difference between the two games. So like the crossover thing.
Yeah, just like their approach to the business model, their approach to mechanics and creeps and things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
That's worth
it. So you guys actually just finished playing a little bit of Infinite Crisis, which is Turbine's.
Right. Yep. This is Turbine's foray into the MOBA space. They have
set in the DC universe.
That's the interesting thing about what they're doing, right? Anybody could make a MOBA right now, and they would have to create, you know, some wacky looking characters. And this is the pirate ranged character, and this is the demon tank character. But because Turbine is owned by Warner Brothers, they have the luxury of having the entire back catalog of DC comics to draw from. Mm-hmm. So they've done that in a way that plays along with the whole kind of Elseworlds concepts in DC comics, where, you know, what if, you know, this happened to the DC multiverse? What if Batman was actually like a nightmare demon creature who preys upon the innocent? Or what if we had these characters set in steampunk landscapes, right?
So is that version of Batman like a skin? Like, does he have the same abilities as normal Batman?
No, he's a totally different character.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there are how many versions of Batman are there in that game? Like three?
There are three Batmen currently.
Yeah. and three Batmans.
Yes.
You know, Batmans. Ben and I were talking to the team at Turbine. We were talking to Cardell Kell over there, who's the creative director.
Kal-El? Sorry, what?
Cardell Kell, yeah. We spoke to Kal-El. He'll really appreciate that. And he was talking about the three Batman characters as different aspects of the main Batman personality, right? When you think of Batman, you think of a few different things, and they wanted to kind of split up those concepts and take them as far as they could go. So that Nightmare Batman that I mentioned, which it almost looks like kind of like a vampirish, like, you know, preying upon the night Batman. Mm-hmm. That's the aspect that they wanted to go for. He's the ultimate source of, like, fear that the criminals would expect in Gotham City. So they just took that concept and pushed it as far as they could go. And it leads to a character that plays very fast, that is very dominating in one-on-one situations, and has a different play style than the other Batmans that they have.
Those kind of creative decisions are really interesting to me. I mean, they could have easily... It's not like the DC universe is short on characters.
Right.
Or any superhero universe. They could have sort of dug into their roster and gotten the more minor characters. If you've seen Justice League Unlimited, which is a pretty cool cartoon.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of characters out there.
They work a lot of people in for just a couple of episodes or story arcs.
Yeah. So just the decision to, like, okay, we know we want to make a MOBA. This is like our assignment, so to speak. I'm imagining them in this scenario. We've got the DC license. What do we do with it? And they decide to sort of do these multiple iterations and multiple parallel universes and things like that of characters. That's kind of an interesting decision.
Yeah. I think it gives them the opportunity to launch with, you know, all the characters that people want to know, people want to love, you know, different versions of Green Lantern, different versions of Superman. Mm-hmm. And then expand out, because, you know, their competition, games like Valve's Dota 2, already has a wide variety of characters to choose from. And, you're building a brand differently, I think, than in that sense than you would if you were playing with DC characters. Like, not everyone's going to want to go and play as Blue Beetle, right? You and I might.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we're going to be super nerdy about it, right? Not everybody wants to be Booster Gold or wants to understand Booster Gold. Yeah. So it gives them an opportunity. I also think it gives them the opportunity to flesh out ideas for the different play styles that they want to include in this game. And Ben and I talked to them a lot about this, mm-hmm. how this compares to other MOBAs in the space. They're trying out a bunch of different ideas and seeing what sticks at this point.
Yeah, I think the highlights are probably that they really want to focus on accessibility, but not at the expense of having a competitive game.
That's tough.
So they had an MLG event recently. I'm not exactly sure what that was, but
they had the game at an MLG event. It wasn't part of the tournament, but they got a lot of people playing it.
Marketing.
Yeah, pretty much.
So I'm not going to ask you guys to give a comprehensive overview of the game. We can talk about it later.
We won.
Nice.
That's super. And Ben did a lot better than me. that's really important to find out.
Cyborg is OP.
But which characters did you play as, and did you like it? Would you recommend people check it out?
I played Cyborg, who is a blaster type.
It's one of the Teen Titans.
Yeah. He shoots like Mega Man. He shoots people.
Yeah.
And he's like an AD carry if you play other MOBA games. And I would say about Infinite Crisis, it's probably actually a good way to get into MOBA games because it has a lot of things that make it simpler and easier to understand. Like recommended items and recommended abilities are all provided for you, so it tells you exactly what you should get.
The inventory right now doesn't feel so much like crafting trees as much as it does like here are just the items that you're going to buy. And you're following a little bit of a progression, but it's not like here are your two items, you put them together and you get this better item, but you've lost all that stuff.
So you buy recipes.
Yeah, you buy like a lantern and then it has five levels and you can continue to upgrade it. But it doesn't actually have a recipe and then certain items that build together to make something better, but
I played as Green Lantern, which is, very much a ranged attacker sort of thing. It doesn't hold up very well in a melee fight. And I would echo what Ben said. It is a good game for those that are learning how to play MOBAs. It's visually dynamic. There are lots of explosions, lots of destructible environments. All the characters look really distinctive. You know, they stand out really well. Plus, I had the nerdy feeling of being Hal Jordan, right? Which is really cool. So we won. We were the only gameplay type that they have right now is a Dominion type of mode where you're capturing points on the map as opposed to playing on a normal 3-lane map. They have stuff like that coming soon. Mm-hmm. This is very much I think it's even still closed beta. But they have been ramping up, letting people in on a pretty consistent basis. I'd definitely keep an eye out for it.
Cool. Thanks for the report, guys. You just came from that, so I thought I'd ask you.
Yeah, it's top of mind right now.
Yeah, like 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that happened this week of note, we're of course cognizant of a certain set of our readership whenever we cover GTA 5. They're asking, why are you guys writing about GTA? It's not even announced for PC. I think we're making the safe assumption that it's going to come out on PC at some point.
You'll see it on PC.
They've been, Rockstar has been hiring people to work on PC ports of their game specifically. And
yeah, that's something we reported on this week, that there's a job posting out there at Rockstar to work on porting an unspecified PC game or games. Hey, it could be Red Dead Redemption for all we know, but some evidence toward GTA 5 happening on PC. Mm-hmm. It is releasing on September 14th on consoles. TJ, you actually did an article a couple months ago estimating the date of release on PC.
How did you do?
I think we put it somewhere in April of 2014 was our suggested date, and like June at the latest.
I think July 4th was the latest.
Oh, July 4th. Yeah, July 4th was what we said was the absolute latest that we think it would come out.
That would have been brilliant marketing on their part.
Yeah.
Put it out on July 4th. Here's the American game.
Wow. Yeah. America.
Yeah.
So we're bringing this up because there's a new and pretty expansive GTA 5 trailer that released this week. About 5 minutes of various gameplay footage. A lot of it, very new, actually. Mm-hmm. So I had all you guys watch it.
Yeah.
I just want to take a moment to reflect on what you liked, what you didn't like.
Who can do the narration voice?
Oh, it's not fresh enough in my head, I don't think.
Yeah, that was one of the things that stuck out to me as bad. So there's this like sort of very sedate, like sober female narrator voice. Mm-hmm. Just felt like an educational film about sex or something.
Or she's like teaching you how to operate the deep fryer or something. Yeah. It's like one
for
of
the
those.
First time in GTA 5, there will be three playable characters.
So
and like one of the characters is cramming like a severed leg into a toilet.
Exactly.
And they're just sort of this tone of like, oh, that guy. I don't know.
It's best
just,
not to hear about.
See, it's kind of like a lack of self awareness in some parts, but you know. It could be worse.
I'm not sure.
Somebody said to me on Twitter, like, what if... Oh, it was Rob Zachney, one of our strategy reporters and freelancers. He's saying, like, well, what if it was, like, the Blam voice? You guys are Blam?
Yeah.
Or it was like, if it was, like, super zany and weird. I don't know. Anyway, so the GTA 5 trailer. What did it show, first of all? What did it break down?
Multiplayer.
We saw multiplayer. Which is very interesting.
18 people, because... I was looking at the names.
Oh, you counted them.
Well, I didn't count all of them, but there was like Dev.
Jake's the intern with the attention to detail.
Beautiful mind kind of thing. But
for trailer analysis specifically.
Just come to me.
That's very nice.
But no. There's like GTA Dev 1, GTA Dev 2, and then it went all the way up to 18. So I saw one that said 18. I'm assuming there was up to 18 people on that map.
Yeah, so there's at least that many.
Yeah, so I thought that was pretty neat.
I feel like there was a lot more for GTA 4, so the player count probably was pretty
GTA
high.
GTA 32?
Yeah.
I believe 32.
32, I'm pretty sure. So, let's talk about that. That was just sort of a tease. It was like one of the smallest parts of the trailer.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting one. It was new information. Mm-hmm. Basically showed, just a character in a skyscraper looking outward, and there are planes and cars and people running around with name tags over their heads like any multiplayer game. No actual information about what the online mode is. They called it GTA Online.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads me to think there's some sort of at least persistent option.
Which is interesting.
Semi-persistent option. Like,
that's very interesting.
Can I be in a certain server with my friends? Mm-hmm. Does the city change over time? I'm mostly interested in what do I do in that context? Because GTA 4's multiplayer had some interesting ideas. I like the cop and robbers mode, but no one played it.
Right.
No one stuck around.
Yeah.
Not even on the consoles, really.
I think people jumped into the free play option or whatever that was called and jumped off skyscrapers, but their modes never really felt fully developed and fully interesting and... Yeah, it lacked sort of the infrastructure persistency around them.
We live in a different time now for sandbox games, too. Yeah. So you have to hope that Rockstar has looked at what's happened in the industry and maybe made some guesses on where things could go. Like, wouldn't it be great if this played like a Minecraft version of GTA, right? Where you're not, which sounds weird when I first say it because GTA is about destruction, not creation, but that level of sandbox environment and like a hosted server kind of thing, that would be my ultimate like hope for that multiplayer mode.
It looked to me like it actually had like free play mode, which was like the headlining thing for GTA 4, but mm-hmm. there were also objectives within that. So like maybe you can actually start playing cops and robbers in the same free play mode session without having to like jump out or anything.
Yeah, because the free play mode in GTA 4 is like a hub, right?
Where you could just go around the city with your friends and do whatever you wanted.
Yeah,
jump out of helicopters. But I think if they could incorporate that and make it not so you had to like queue up in like a matchmaking type thing to get into like death matches or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that would be great. Like if they just kind of threw people into
it. Because it seemed to me like the guy in the skyscraper was watching someone play cops and robbers because there were cop cars and they were going around the city and there was a jet doing something else. So it could be where they're all happening at the same time, maybe not necessarily directly connected, but in the same environment.
Yeah.
I was more interested, rather than the multiplayer, I was more interested in the whole switching between characters aspect, mostly because I'm not sure how I feel about it at this point.
I'm still really worried about it.
Yeah, I don't know, because, like, I kind of feel like it's taking control out of your hands. Like, if I want to do something on this character, and then, but, like, the character I'm just playing as like my sandbox character, he's going to maybe go off and do things I don't want him to do while I'm checking in on this other guy over here.
Yeah, so they're playing up this notion of like, and I think they're overselling it. I do think it's marketing. I don't think it's implemented in the way that we sort of hope it to be or that they indicate it will be, but they use the word voyeur. Like you get sort of like, I'm playing as this guy, and then I'm going to switch over to this guy, and he's going to be like doing something with his family.
Now, I had a question about that. Is like the family guy, I forget his name, like Frank.
Michael? I think Michael
He looks like the guy from Dead Rising.
Yeah. But he, what if you're like out, what if you switch to him, you're out with your family? Like, can you just go around and just go on a shooting rampage and get 5 stars? Or like, what would his family think? How would that affect
the
story?
There are like certain triggers that are going to pop up, like you're, I don't know, in some story segment. I have no idea. Yeah. But mainly, like, I do think they're overstating, like, how dynamic that is.
Yeah.
That, like, their lives are going to progress in the background separately.
That's never worked out.
I don't think that's going to be the case.
Skyrim.
But in terms of, I mean, one concrete way that they did show this, they showed a heist, you know, sort of a, like, a kidnapping mission with a helicopter. So one of the characters is rappelling down the helicopter, down an office building, breaks through the window, steals a guy, grabs him, and then, like, screams over his headset, like, I need help or something.
Yeah.
And you switch to the other character and you provide sniping support and take out the guys that are, you know, pointing guns at him. I don't want to do that in a game.
Really?
I don't want to jump between perspectives like I'm some sort of weird ghost.
Well, if you're jumping between perspectives like that, is that something you're in full control of, or the game is forcing you to do that as part of the narrative?
I think you're in control of. I think.
Yeah. I feel like that's actually giving me way too many toys to play with.
Mm-hmm. Like, I just feel like it's unnecessary and doesn't...
If you can't design a mission that I can't solve with having an AI sniper support, then...
I'd rather be focused on the experience of the mission itself, the narrative, like, the dialogue, what's happening in front of me, being this character, who am I, what are my motivations, the level geometry, than, like, the mechanics of, oh, to win, I need to switch out to this guy. And then, like, I don't want to game it in a GTA game in that way.
It seemed like a lazy way to integrate co-op into the single-player experience without having it separate. So, like, you have the three characters, and your friends can probably play as the two other dudes while you're playing the mission or something.
Maybe, I mean...
You think so?
I would hope so.
That would be incredible.
It would be a really awesome experience to have
I think that's a hopeful wish.
Like, I think that might... I was thinking that might be, like, that's a path that they
If you
could
can
take.
Switch to it, you could probably have someone...
Yeah, why not?
But then,
when you get out of that mission, what happens? Are your friends just, like, doing your story content for those characters separately?
I don't know.
Do all of the campaign... Like, certainly, I can't imagine all of the campaign missions involve all three characters.
Right.
Yeah.
Some of them have to be separate.
Yeah. It's probably split up into, like, four arcs, right? You're going to get stories for each of them, and then some other are going to converge.
I mean, it does have some cool, promising aspects in terms of pacing, like, you know, being able to jump to a different character, sort of, like... Is a natural storytelling tool,
right?
Mm-hmm. I guess, but mechanically, in terms of gameplay, in terms of like, use this guy to drive the car, and use this guy to, I don't know. Like they showed a bank heist, and I don't know. Presumably, like one character could like drive the car to block the truck that has all the money, and the other guy drives a car to like slam into the truck, to knock it over, and the third guy comes in, gets the money or something, and I don't know, like. Just make me one of those
dudes. That's so many variables for the kind of emergent gameplay that you're going to
want. It seems too video gamey.
Exactly.
It makes it like, here's a mechanic, let's jump to this mechanic, let's do that, and we get through all of them.
And it seems a little weird that, oh my God, Speculation City, but doesn't it seem a little weird that we would be thinking that Rockstar might be going too video gamey? Like, I had gotten the sense that they wanted to take Grand Theft Auto was into more of like a big crime city narrative sort of feel, and what we're talking about with these three different characters, it could go in either direction. I can't see either direction working out that well. Like if they use three characters in the service of the story, it's going to feel very much like, okay, you've played through this section, now you're going to move to this next person, and maybe they're showing cameos. If it's just a gameplay mechanic thing, like I'm going to be so awkward at trying to use three characters to rob a bank.
I mean,
it's going to be awful.
I'm sure that like the way I see it, like during the sniper mission, maybe like the first time you encounter that kind of mechanic, they're going to ask you to switch. But then every time after that, they'll probably be like, well, if you want to switch, you can. Otherwise, AI will snipe. Or AI will drive the helicopter. And I think, I mean, being able to switch then would just become an option. Like, if you want to, like, maybe...
What if my dude's across town? Well, the other dude's across town?
No, this is like you're in a mission, though. And, like, with the separate thing, I don't know how that's going to work.
All right, so...
It's very strange.
Some amount of skepticism or just wondering how that's going to be implemented... Anything else that stuck out to you guys? I mean, the world looks ridiculously good.
Sports.
Yeah. It almost looks like it's going to be more of the map is going to be wilderness than is, you know, taken up by the actual city of Los Santos, which I don't think is something they've done before. I mean, San Andreas was kind of half and half, maybe.
Like having outskirts and stuff?
Well, they've had outskirts before because, I mean, San Andreas had the huge wilderness areas, but this looks like, you know, you're going to have... the city in the middle, and then just ton of stuff around it with little towns and gas stations and stuff like that.
Yeah, to the extent that hunting animals is a...
Right, yeah.
I hesitate to call it a minigame, but just a thing you can do in the world, as is golfing, cycling...
tennis.
Did you guys notice that
Diving.
All the characters have stats, which is coming back from San Andreas, too.
Yeah, interesting.
And it seemed that those level up over time based on, I don't know, either minigames like... lifting or something like that.
Yeah. Going to the gym in a video game instead of going to the gym in real life.
They showed a shooting range, and there was a shooting stat in that little right-hand corner.
Yeah.
The shooting looked good to me. It's hard to tell in a video, but GTA 4 kind of had weird shooting.
They definitely pulled some Max Payne.
The problem with GTA 4 is that it was tuned for using a controller, and they didn't make it any harder for mouse players, so you just could headshot everything.
I played it on a 360, and I still thought the shooting was kind of not.
It is, because they're still stuck in this weird hybrid between like Z-axis targeting or whatever, the lock-on style targeting, and. You know, they hadn't figured out that, hey, everyone has abandoned that in the third person space like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know, for one thing, just the thing that struck me, how much I miss the satire and humor of GTA. They're sort of like cynical indictment of every type of entertainment, social group, like Los Angeles in general is such a...
It is kind of taking itself too seriously.
It is?
I think so.
How?
Well, I think what I'm saying, I'm trying to agree with you. I miss that satire that used to be there.
Oh, okay.
I don't feel like it's there as much anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the encouraging things I saw was like, there's sort of their recreation of the Chinese theater in Hollywood, and there's like a guy in a Republican Space Ranger suit fighting with some other costume dude. I'm like, yes, bring that back.
Yeah.
But I mean, they just have such an interesting worldview that they share in their games that is heavily cynical and hilarious, I think, and detailed, and their writing is so consistently good.
Isn't it strange that out of the thing that I always come back to from the GTA series is the parody radio stations?
Oh
yeah.
All I really want is more of that.
Just listening to it. Yeah.
And I don't know if they had any of the radio stations in the trailer.
No. It was all narrated. So.
Yeah.
None of that.
I'm sure that they'll be back. That's like a staple of GTA.
Oh yeah.
I hope so.
No, they'll be there. One thing I like that we hadn't talked about yet is how you can do different mission, like paths for a mission. So like they showed the jewelry heist and it was like you can either go in with gas and poison everyone or you can just bust in with guns and be really
loud. We don't
know
if it was poison.
Well,
could have been a sedative. They brought up this notion of like, okay, there's like a dialogue line. We can either do this smart or do it loud or something, dumb and loud. Yeah, and they're sort of hinting at like, hey, you can like plan your heists, but I'm skeptical that that's the case. It's probably going to be, at worst, it'll be a binary thing where, hey, we can just barge in and shoot people,
or you can try to sneak in,
gas in, or maybe they'll have sort of these like toggleable elements where like, okay, do you want to pay for, or do you want to hire, or do you want to have this element of like, we'll have this type of getaway car or this type or. You can escape on motorcycles. I don't know. Elements that you can sort of just toggle in that way.
That would be kind of neat.
I don't know if
I want to be able to plan so much that the heist goes off perfectly because
helicopter.
GTA is all about like creating chaos and then finding a way out of it. But having some choices of the different elements that would be involved without having to like it'd be nice to have like there's a motorcycle here that I can use without having to go and find that motorcycle somewhere in the world and bring it back and make sure I don't wreck it, right? But I tend to agree with you, Evan. I think it's going to be a little more of a binary choice. I think it's going to be like here are your two options for doing this, and at the end of the day, they're not really going to change anything that much. But at least you feel like you have a little bit of choice.
Yeah, that's realistic, and I think that's a fine expectation to have.
Maybe it'll be like morality, like you could kill people or you could get people hostage.
Oh, I can't see morality.
You're robbing a bank either way.
I know. Yeah. I'm just saying they might just try to introduce that.
Yes. Who knows? Something I left that trailer with no understanding of is just how this game is going to resolve, what its sort of main narrative is, what the sort of central problem is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like that, you know, GTA 4, part of its criticism was like it navigated this weird sort of conspiracy plot line and the government was involved and like, you know, you're searching for your past, you know, pretty interesting character type for them to explore, but ultimately not that interesting.
Right.
I like the idea of them exploring like these three different types of heist characters and their various crime careers and what their motivations are, what life looks for them after retirement in one case. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's like, what's It's like, I want to know, like, what's the villain? What's the, is there a villain? I don't know. Like, what's the issue that they're dealing with together?
I feel like we'll know the closer we get, though. Like, if this was, this almost feels like this was the big coming out party. Like, here is GTA 5. The closer we get to it, the more they're going to, the more the marketing for the game is really going to set that tone and let us know what to expect out of it. In the same way that GTA 4 very, very quickly became kind of like this American, like it was almost about the American dream and all the things that were messed up in it. But I have that same sense. I have no idea where the story for this will go.
Yeah.
But after looking at the gorgeous engine, I'm not so sure I cared. I just wanted to run around in that world for a little bit.
All right. So I guess we'll await more marketing. Hooray. All right, so that's kind of wrapping up the big releases this week, the big events of this week. Let's talk about what we're playing this coming weekend. Steam sales happening. I'm playing Borderlands 2, getting back into the DLC. I haven't touched any of the DLC.
Are you playing solo?
Yeah.
Are you just not into multiplayer for Borderlands 2?
I don't know. I could do that. It's sort of a hassle to find somebody sometimes.
I've heard half and half on. I mean, right. I played a large part of Borderlands 1 solo and treated it very much like you would if you were playing through Diablo by yourself, right?
It's don't just kind of oh, no, exactly. Terrible. I mean, like, any.
Tell us how you really feel, Ben Bot.
I reviewed Borderlands 2 for my college paper, and I had it before any of my friends got it, and I played it alone, and it was really, really tough and
emo.
Fun.
Ben Bot is weird.
My friends bought it in like a 4-pack a week after it came out, and I had already finished it.
I mean, the thing that always happens to me, and this is true of games where you shoot enemies and loot drops out of them, and they're cooperative.
Right.
Titan Quest was one of the first games that I had this experience in. Things just accelerate in an uncomfortable way. Everyone's just concerned with knocking down enemies and getting loot as quickly as possible, as efficiently as possible in a multiplayer context. At least the people I've played with, it's just very like, kill loot, kill loot, kill loot. And like, someone inevitably is getting ahead of the group.
It's a competitive where you like, start fighting against each other and get the best gun.
You were playing with the wrong people.
And you just like... Everybody just develops this tunnel vision of just destruction and consumption.
Yeah, loot.
In a way that, you know, they're skipping the dialogue things, the boss introduction, they're just, you know, and I want to, Borderlands 2 has some pretty damn good writing and some really good enemy design that I relish in and pretty darn good environments and just amazing polish and presentation and fit and finish that I want to sort of absorb at my own pace. So that's my argument for playing it alone.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Cool.
Civ 5. Because I haven't played Civ 5 since, you know, I put 120 hours into vanilla Civ, and then I stopped. Like, I didn't
how many? I'm sorry, how many?
120. What?
Oh, good Lord.
It's not that much.
It's a good time to stop.
190.
Yeah, I mean, look at TJ over here.
Oh, is this a competition now? Do you guys duke it out?
This is a competition.
Have a slap fight over who played more Civ?
In grand strategy games, it's accomplishment to get like 100 plus hours.
So you're playing Brave New World.
Yeah. I'm just, because all the new mechanics, like I said, I didn't get Gods and Kings, and so going directly to Brave New World, it's like, a lot of new stuff.
That's a lot to learn.
Awesome. So it's almost like a new game, and a lot of stuff's changed. Like, I don't know, I can get truffles now in the woods. I mean, I'm pretty happy about that. So just doing, like, it's just re-experiencing Civ again with Brave New World, so it's kind of a good jumping off point for me. So I'll be playing that as much as possible.
Would you have bought truffles as a separate DLC?
I would
have. They had sold it?
Yeah, day one.
Yeah.
It's like $2.99.
Yeah, it does the exact same thing as all other luxury resources. You're just paying for the fact that it's truffles.
Exactly. Wow.
It's an option.
I mean, bacon. They could put bacon in. That would be...
Oh, yeah. Why don't they have bacon as a luxury resource?
Can't we do that?
That would be awesome.
I hope they're listening.
I'm going to look for Civ 5 bacon mods.
Yeah,
if not, it would be pretty easy to make.
Yeah.
I mean, just need to make an icon for it and use the same code as all the other luxury resources.
I mean, pigs, truffles are essentially bacon. I mean, I could just imagine them as bacon.
Oh, yeah, because they show up as pigs.
I need an icon on the map that is like two wavy pieces of crispy bacon.
Yeah.
Anything less than that is not going to hit the mark.
It can only spawn in the desert, and it's like already frying on the sand.
Right?
That'd be awesome.
Now you're thinking.
I just want to add various food items as luxury items in the Civ. Eggs, you know, milk.
Yeah.
I mean, cats.
Yeah.
I got to ask first, Evan. Did you find it?
There's a YouTube video that claims to add bacon in some capacity.
Excellent.
Okay. I'm still investigating, and we'll report back.
Yeah. More as it follows. I am still playing the ever-loving crap out of Rogue Legacy, which I don't...
Oh, maybe
I can't
it means
remember.
Francis Bacon.
Francis Bacon is available.
Father of empiricism.
Is he a leader or is he a great person?
I'm still determining.
Okay. Probably not as tasty as Bacon.
Stand by.
Have you ever tasted Francis Bacon? You can't make that statement. That's journalistically irresponsible.
Jeez.
To just assume that he probably doesn't taste as good.
Pretty sure you can't come with a managing editor like that. I'm pulling rank right now. I am playing a lot of Rogue Legacy still. And we'll continue to play it because it is a ton of fun. I can't remember if we've talked about it on the podcast here or not.
I don't think so.
Don't recall that
so
we have.
So Rogue Legacy is a side-scrolling 2D Rogue Light. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's like the same thing as like playing Rogue or NetHack or something like that, but definitely has a lot of roguelike qualities. Feels very much almost like playing a Castlevania game.
That's awesome.
You are playing kind of a generation of characters. So every character that you play progresses through a randomly generated castle and the surrounding areas of that, trying to get as far as you can, getting past enemies that are ridiculously powerful, and eventually dying. And when you die, you leave everything to your heir, who picks up, you know, all of your equipment and your stats and stuff like that, and goes back in and has to start fresh on money. So you're making a lot of runs through the game to earn as much money as possible so you can buy new equipment, buy new stats. And then eventually there are four bosses in each section of the game that you want to kill, leading up to, I believe, a final boss. I haven't made it to the final boss yet, but I've put in something like 14 hours in the game so far.
Yes. Wow.
And I'm absolutely smitten with it.
It's like that iOS game.
Infinity Blade.
Yeah. You die and then your air.
Yeah,
comes
same sort of concept. Yep. Absolutely. Except this is very retro 2D.
Yeah, Castlevania like.
Very, very Castlevania. Like, almost like Ghouls and Ghosts, I think.
Yeah.
You are a dude, or actually sometimes you're a lady, and they all have different genetic traits every time you choose a new character, and those traits can be both useful and often comical. So color blindness is a thing where you'll
yeah, you were showing me that.
You'll choose a character and the whole game will be in black and white. I'm sorry, we have a report from the field.
Had a breakthrough.
And the bacon?
What
the
is
bacon report?
So I typed bacon into the Civ 5 Steam Workshop.
Yes.
And there's a mod called, with 4 out of 5 stars.
Okay.
Yummy bacon. replaces truffles with bacon.
Someone already did it.
This is excellent.
Yeah, and it like gives 2 times the happiness or something.
Yes.
I'm curious as to why only 4 out of 5 stars.
Not sure.
Didn't taste
we might have to do some future reporting on
but
that.
It exists. There you go. PC Gamer Podcast.
All right.
Okay, we need to add that to our mod list. But,
so color blindness in Rogue Legacy makes everything black and white. There are other things like baldness.
You showed me, I think it was nearsightedness makes everything around you blurry.
Right. Or farsightedness, where everything around your character is blurry, but you can see everything else, and as you move, like, things become harder to see. There's even nostalgia.
What?
Like, your character will just be... Or there's ADHD, which will make you move much faster in the game. So some of these are useful, and some of them are just goofy, right?
Yeah.
Fear of chickens. So the main way that you replenish your health in the game is that, you know, as you're bashing items, sometimes there will be chicken that falls out, and you eat that. If you are afraid of chickens, the chicken will attack you and then run away, and you have to go and kill the chicken, and it's a very strange thing. Or even, like... kind of perfect memory, so that as you're moving through areas, you'll get on your map a radar sense of where the enemies are, so you know where to go back and attack them. Or insanity. Dementia. There's dementia where there will be enemies sometimes that you think you need to attack and you can't hurt them for some reason. It's because they're not there. So there a lot of those are interesting, and it makes for really interesting DLC ideas later on.
Yeah.
But just the sense of progression that's in the game has been really enjoyable. At first, it was really hard. I'm like sitting in the office playing it, you know, on a Friday and cursing at the screen, and nobody knew why, because you guys are probably actually all doing work. And and the more frustrated I got, the I'd get a little bit farther and a little bit farther, and I started getting more money. And eventually, I'm upgrading enough skills or unlocking enough runes, which are kind of like special powers, like flight or sliding vampirism. So every time I kill an enemy, I get a little bit of their health back, and that was enough to start helping me figure out what I needed to do. And that sense of progression is something over the past few years that I've really been interested in games. So this is a good way to jump into that if you've never played a roguelike before.
I'm just so glad developers are finding interesting things to do with death.
Right.
I mean, Dark Souls is a great example of that. DayZ, just permadeath, FTL.
Yes.
Making consequences matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this game could easily be some sort of platformery Castlevania game where you die and you just restart, or you die and...
And there's a checkpoint or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, just one interesting thing they do that I read about was, you know, you take the gold that you know, that character dies, you bring that gold back to camp with your new character.
And you spend all that gold.
And you have to spend all of it because you walk through this sort of, checkpoint. You cross this threshold into the castle and you have to give up all that extra gold.
In order to get into the castle, you have to give all your money to death. So you can't keep any of that. There's a skill you can unlock later on where you can keep a very small percentage of that, but it helps, but even then you're stuck. There's also an engineer character that you can unlock in that camp area. Every time you go into the castle with a new character, the map resets. It's totally random every time, unless you talk to the engineer who can lock down the castle, and it can be exactly the same as the ancestor that you played as before, but you're only going to get 70% of the gold. And so you have to start making interesting decisions about, well, is this a gold farming run? Am I going to try to collect as much money as possible? Am I hoping for, like, you know, 14,000 gold? Or do I have a character that I think is strong enough that I can try to go go open some of the chests that I missed last time, or even take on a boss? Mm-hmm. And you're always giving something up. Those interesting decisions are what's really important in a game like this. And I think you're absolutely right. It's becoming a more prevalent trend to make death a key part of that.
Yeah, and just the notion of making each life an attempt.
Right.
You know, that, you're gaining something over time, so there is a sense of growth and persistency, but...
I talked to a couple people who finally beat the game, and the number of people in their family tree that they've gone through is just ridiculous. So that's Rogue Legacy. It's on sale on Steam right now. It's not on like a daily sale or anything. I think it's only like $12 down from $15. But keep an eye out for that, because I'm sure it will go on a slightly deeper discount.
Awesome.
I have been playing Brave New World with Jake, and I learned recently that newest intern PC bacon. Gamer is
no.
is a terrible person.
I
terrible, terrible person.
All right, I'm going to tell you what happened from an impartial point of view.
Yeah, the third party.
We are playing a three-player game, Civilization V, with some AI. We all spawn on the same continent. There's no other civs on our continent. It's just us three. Okay, so Jake is playing as the Shoshone, and Ben is the Assyrians. They're both two of the new civs. And I'll try to make this fairly quick, but basically Ben saw the new Shoshone Explorer unit thing, and he said he wanted to attack it just to see what it would do or something like that. So, you know, if you attack at other civs' units, you're automatically at war. And this basically launched this, like, recursive revenge loop blood feud that is going on up to this day. It's been going on in the actual in-game clock that tells you what year it is for, like, something like 2,000 years, maybe more than that, between the Assyrians and the Shoshone. And it has wound up with Ben being very far behind because he got you spent a lot of your starting production on a settler, and then that got captured, and then you just started putting all of your production after that into military units back at Jake.
My problem with Jake is that I attacked him, and then I sent him a peace treaty immediately afterwards, and he stole one of my settlers before he accepted the peace treaty, so I had to wait 10 turns
before I could claim my revenge. Back up.
Yeah. So
you attacked him.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Step one.
Yep.
Right.
Then you sent him a peace treaty. He was like, oh, just kidding.
Jake and I were going to make peace. It was accepted. It was an accepted fact. And he decided to steal my settler.
TJ, what are you doing in the middle of all this?
I'm just
fighting England.
Aside from winning the game.
I'm just up in the north playing as,
Zulus.
The Zulu. And kicking England's ass and building cities that these two don't know about and winning the game.
Spoilers.
Last time I checked, I'm on the top of the scoreboard, which I know doesn't mean a whole lot, but also, Ben, he attacked me first. So then, when he sent me
that... treaty. No. I sent you a peace treaty.
You can't break a treaty that was never signed.
I did not add a little term that said, give him my settlers.
This is exactly like what is going on in the Middle East. It's completely confusing who started the conflict in the first place.
Starts imitating life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And, so...
No honor.
I took his settler. I accepted the peace treaty. We had 10 turns of this relative tentative peace.
No, I immediately wanted to attack you. with
so then I'm hearing about a lot of dick moves between the two of you, to be honest.
I attacked him. I told him I was going to attack him, and then he stole my cell. Then we made the peace treaty.
Oh, God. TJ, please save us before this goes into, like, Dr. Phil territory.
All right. Well,
aside from Civ 5.
Aside from Civ 5, which I've been playing some single player too as well, outside from our multiplayer game, the three of us. I just today jumped back into War of the Roses. I can't really say why, because I'm under NDA.
It was very distracting while I was...
Yeah, but I like that game a lot, and I'd like to see what that studio does in the future.
That's incredibly
yeah,
vague.
Yeah, exactly.
So keep an eye out on PCGamer.com.
Exactly. Around Gamescom, yeah. There's going to be an announcement relating to that of some kind.
Well, since you can't say much about that yet, and
right.
Just to go back to Civ 5 and close all the loops, we actually have an interview that you did for Civ 5.
Right. I have an interview with Ed Beach, who is the lead designer on the Brave New World expansion, and Dennis Shirk, who is one of the producers for Civ 5. And we talked about a whole bunch of stuff, mostly related to Brave New World. A little bit about, you know, might there be future expansions or DLC for Civ 5?
Right.
And a lot of stuff like that. How they choose which civilizations to put in the game, which ones, you know, almost made it. A lot of cool stuff like that.
Great. Well, I think we're going to close out the show on that interview, give people something to listen to. That's going to do it for us here. As always, please go to PCGamer.com and check out all the information that we have there, including TJ's upcoming tease about War of the Roses that he doesn't want to tell us about now, even as we're sitting here.
I can't tell you about now.
He won't even tell us as we're sitting here. we have lots of really great content coming along. For Evan Lottie, for No Honor Jake Gooden,
thank you.
For Ben Bott, who gets the last name because robots don't have last names or feelings. For TJ Hafer, I'm Corey Banks, and we'll see you next week.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the PC Gamer Podcast. This week we have Ed Beach, the lead designer on Civilization Brave New World, and Dennis Shirk, one of the producers on Civilization 5, to talk to us about the new expansion and some of the new civilizations and their mechanics. How's it going, guys?
It's going great. Not much time left till we actually get this on the street.
And hello, everyone. This is Ed.
Yes, it's coming up pretty quick here, first or second Tuesday in July, I think.
Yep.
So I'll just start with a very broad, when you guys were, you know, first outlining Brave New World as a product, what were like the big points you wanted to hit that you felt like, you know, needed to round out the Civilization 5 experience?
We wanted to look at the whole session that you have as you get all the way through the game, look at the four different ways you can win the game, those different victory types, and try to figure out which ones we felt like were the most interesting and which ones we could really ratchet up a notch. So we did that, and we kind of targeted two different things we wanted to address with Brave New World. One was we wanted to make the end of the game sort of from the modern age all the way through the 20th century until the victory. We wanted to make that have just as many critical decisions that turned the way the game played out. We wanted to make sure you were chock full of interesting, tough strategic choices there. And then we also wanted to look at out of the four different ways to win the game, we wanted to look most carefully at the diplomatic victory and the cultural victory. We felt like those victory paths were a little bit too passive. You could sort of build up a good infrastructure, but you didn't really have to interact with the other civilizations in the game world. And so we wanted to make them kind of turn them on the head and make them something where you had to engage with the other players in the game and really build some type of coalition or amazing culture to win the game.
So when you were, you know, designing these new features for the expansion, did the civs you decided to put in, did you give any weight to kind of the new mechanics you were adding for culture and diplomacy, or how do you decide, you know, what new civs you're going to include with an expansion?
There definitely was some consideration of that type, and there are a couple like really clear examples of that. For instance, we have a new trade route system, mm-hmm. and so a lot of the gold that your economies develop now are through international trade routes with other powers in the game. And if you look at, say, Portugal and also Morocco.
Oh, yeah. Got to play Morocco in the press preview.
Right. That just sort of naturally fit with that trade game. So that was part of the consideration of choosing new civs, but there actually was a lot more that went into it than just that one consideration.
There's also a lot of fan considerations, too, because we've had a lot of civs that fans want to see in the game, and we hear it often, especially somebody like Shaka, who's been in all the versions of Civilization. He's a stalwart. Why isn't he not part of Civilization 5 yet? So some of them are shout-outs to the fans to really just include some of the ones that they've really been waiting for.
So the two new ones that are kind of just being announced right before the expansion goes out are Venice and the Shoshone. And I remember when I got the press builds a while back, the entries for those guys were in there, but we weren't allowed to talk about them yet. And Venice just kind of blew my mind, where they're essentially, they're like a city-state almost. Like, where did the idea for that, their whole mechanic, come from?
Well, originally they were in Civ 5 as a city-state.
Right, right.
So we started kicking around ideas. We were sort of focused on Renaissance Italy and modern Italy and whether or not that was worthy of inclusion as another civilization. Rome's always been in the game, but there's been a lot of, you know, sort of progression to Italian civilization from that point forward. So we thought about an Italy civ, and we also came up to the idea that during the Renaissance, Venice had this huge trading empire all up and down the Adriatic coast and all the way over to the Levant, and interact with the Ottoman Empire in a whole bunch of different conflicts, and sort of dominated the spice trade into Europe until that got shut off by the Ottoman Empire. So they really were a very significant player. But we were like, well, they already are in the game as a city-state. You know, can we really elevate them to become a full civ now? And all of a sudden that just sort of struck us as, what if you actually sort of played them as a city-state or as a sort of single primary city power? That would be actually a very interesting new twist to the gameplay. And we're up to 43 civilizations in Civ 5 right now. So we had to kind of think outside the box for some of the things to come up with unique abilities. And so this one just seemed like it was fully out of the box,
yeah,
and therefore very interesting.
It's in a completely different box.
We consider this kind of a pro mode civ. Your casual player might have a lot of fun with it, but might have more of a challenge playing it versus somebody who's played for a while and really is familiar with the mechanics.
And I guess for people who might not have, you know, been reading the articles that have come out today, basically, they can't ever found or conquer cities, if I'm understanding that correctly.
They're not able to build settlers.
Right.
So that shuts off a huge avenue. The whole normal expansion path just doesn't exist for them. And then if they were ever able to acquire a city, like through conquest, they always have to turn it into a puppet city, which means they can't really control the production queue for that city. It will be part of their empire, but that city's still going to operate pretty autonomously. But the one thing that they can do in their puppeted cities is they are allowed to use their massive treasury to buy units and buildings there.
Gotcha.
And therefore, Venice gameplay is all centered around amassing a huge treasury and how you go about spending it. And you can do things like, they actually have a special unit called the Merchant of Venice, who's like our great merchant in that he can go to other city-states and have trade missions there. But he has sort of a special trade mission where he goes and he just buys out the city-state. And it becomes one of these puppeted cities. So they don't have to gain puppets through conquest. They can do it with these trade missions. And that's a really important part of the Venice gameplay, because what you're going to find is they get twice as many trade routes as every other power in the game. And so setting up the most profitable, lucrative, interesting trade route system is sort of what you're doing with their expansion. And if you can find that city state that's in this sort of interesting choke point where all the oceans and seas of your world come together, that one can be a very instrumental trading base of operations outside of Venice. And that's sort of the city state you want to go, send your merchant to, get that under control, and then start trading from there. And it's a new hub of trade that really expands your presence across the sort of economic footprint of the world.
And they can be pretty dangerous too. People may think about it as, oh, I only have one city that's truly under my control. But Venice, we find, gets pumped up to be a humongous mega city. And especially as a human player, one of the strategies that you want is to be pointing trade routes back at yourself from your puppeted city states, bringing in food, production, because you can make it quite large. And because you've got all of these economic benefits as Venice, you've got a lot of gold. Late in the game, between all your puppeted cities, your puppeted city states, you can field an army instantly if you need to. If you've got a defense issue, if you've got an aggressive neighbor, you can get very dangerous very quickly. So it's really a fun sit to play if you know what you're doing.
I also I'm kind of a big I'm also a big fan of the one city challenge, and Venice seems like the absolute ideal Civ to try that with.
Yeah, I was going to say that it was also a challenge to us as AI programmers to get our AI code to be able to play Venice well and put up this brand new challenge to a human player playing against a Venice opponent. But I'm very happy to report that in my latest game of Civ that I just played through this week, Venice was my number one opponent. They kept getting to all the cultural wonders right before I did. It was infuriating, actually. Yeah. I actually had to deviate from the cultural victory that I was planning to go for and go for a diplomatic one instead, just because Venice was always one step ahead of me on the cultural path.
They can generate a huge amount of science from their network of puppeted cities. They have a super city in the middle that has an absurd amount of production. So once they actually unlock a wonder in the tech tree, they can build it quickly. And they can be really dangerous.
Awesome. Who else have you guys seen, like, of the new civs that ends up being really dangerous? I know when I played it for a preview a couple months ago, Assyria was kicking ass pretty early on.
Yeah, Assyria and the Zulu are the two new military powers, and you have to watch out for them. Especially early, the Assyrians have their siege towers, which can take down cities very, very quickly. So if you spawn in next to them, you have to watch for that early attack. And then the Zulu are dangerous a little bit later in the game. Once they get to the point where they get massive swarms of Impi warriors, they get all sorts of special promotions from their unique barracks. They're extremely good at swarming you with a lot of cheaply produced units that you just can't fend off the numbers.
It's actually pretty funny when we have to put together batches of screenshots from time to time for, you know, marketing and to send out to preview writers and stuff like that. So we use the tuner and autoplay through the game to get to a late point in the game so we can grab screenshots from the middle of the game or the modern era. And it's always hilarious and a little frustrating. You're getting your work done, you're watching this autoplay trigger over on your monitor, and then all of a sudden you see the Zulu appear and they start destroying the entire map and then knock you out of the game, and the game just ends before you get to where you're trying to get to. It can be scary on higher difficulty levels, how strong the Zulu are and how much of a headache they can cause you if you're trying to play your perfect peaceful game. It really adds some nice wild card possibilities to the expansion when we added in so many peaceful options.
So the other civ you guys have just announced is the Shoshone, and they I believe their bonuses are their cities start with more land, and their scout can choose the benefit from ancient ruins instead of getting a random one.
Correct. Yep. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to fool around with them yet.
No, not yet.
But when they plop down their cities, I believe, how many tiles is it?
12.
Yeah, they plop down with 12 tiles that are kind of that draw outward how you would normally acquire tiles. So you get some really interesting blobs of territory. But they can acquire territory very quickly early on, and we like that whole thought of the Great Expanse. They're that kind of northwestern, Midwest Northwest Native American tribe, and they had a lot of territory that they had to worry about. It was one of their primary concerns in real life. So we thought it'd be really neat to actually start them out that way, to have these big swaths of open land for them. So you can actually use that in a lot of fun, interesting ways. We've seen saves come back from QA where they've actually used their settlers aggressively to surround other cities to make sure their territories are locked in versus other civilizations. You can have a lot of fun with their Pathfinder unit. Their Pathfinder is a scout that actually fights like a warrior. But when he actually finds a ruin, he gets to choose the upgrade from the ruin. Now, this isn't something where you can take advantage of it. You can't choose upgrade unit 5 times in a row. Once you've chosen upgrade unit, you have to choose something else next time and choose something else next time. But it's nice to be able to plan out your order of the benefits you're going to get from these scouts. So it's nice to build a few of these right away, send them out across the territory. You can fight barbarians with them. They're a great early game sieve.
What kind of victory conditions have you guys seen most commonly with the Shoshone?
Well, it's an interesting puzzle. I think they're pretty much open to anything because they do get that early jump start with extra land that everyone else has, more than everyone else has. But the big sort of double-edged sword with them is that land acquisition typically makes some of your neighbors into enemies very, very early. So it's a trade-off. You can grab extra land right away, but you're going to have to pay the diplomatic consequences. So probably the one victory path I would say that's least likely for them to be able to achieve is the diplomatic victory. They could probably go any of the other three equally well, the conquest, the diplomatic, or the cultural. But I would hesitate to try to play them diplomatically because those big land grabs you get early in the game tend to attract everyone else's attention, and everyone else covets those lands, and you'll be embroiled in some conflicts pretty quickly.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about Venice that it was kind of thought of as a pro civ. There's a couple others in there that have kind of struck me that way, too. Indonesia seems that way a little bit. Did you guys kind of aim towards adding higher difficulty civilizations since this is kind of the last big expansion for Civ 5?
I wouldn't necessarily identify the others as pro so much. They're, even Indonesia is still a traditional functioning civ when you think about the way that you play the game and the way that the game comes out. Venice was more of a complete mechanics overhaul of a civ, and that's why we really thought of it as a pro civ, because you had to really change the way that you even approach the game to play them. I really like Indonesia because of some of the aspects it has, especially with its random sword promotion on its unique unit, which is very cool. The fact that you can get some extra happiness when you're founding your cities on other continents. But it's definitely still going to feel very approachable and familiar to people that have played other civs in the game.
So I think rather than looking for necessarily pro challenging type of civs, what we were just trying to do is look at the fact we already had 34 different unique abilities, each of those trying to represent a different play style or a different path through the game. And so trying to come up with 9 more play styles was definitely an exercise in pushing the envelope a little bit. And so some of them do probably come out a little bit more as pro civs, but it wasn't that we were deliberately trying to do that. It was more that we were trying to find yet another set of 9 new play styles to represent.
So one of the other little things that has almost kind of fallen through the cracks a little bit in the expansion feature list, you guys made some changes to France in relation to the new culture victory. I'm curious why France specifically, and if maybe you looked at some other civs, because, I mean, there's a lot of them in there, a lot of new mechanics, and, you know, if there were other ones you considered changing as well.
I'd say there were a couple of reasons we chose France. One was we always thought that they should be a civ that has the leg up on everyone else in terms of getting to the culture victory. And their old bonus didn't do that anymore. Now you really need tourism as what you're outputting in order to get to the culture victory. You don't need just to acquire social policies like before. So their previous bonus gave them culture, and that didn't really work anymore. Secondly, I went to France for the first time last summer, had a great time touring around the French Chateau and the Louvre, and You might also notice that the Louvre is one of the most powerful wonders in the game, especially for the cultural player. That's mm-hmm. the only one you can get a +8 theming bonus on, and actually France can get that up to +16. So it's definitely sort of inspired by my travels that we need to do something more interesting with them. And then the third thing was just that their bonus didn't really change. The only thing it did for changing your play style was just made you want to drop down as many cities across the map as possible, because the bonus was just +2 culture per city created. And you know, there's plenty of things in the game that already encourage you to found a lot of cities. This was not really any kind of groundbreaking new play style. And we feel like the new France, with the chateau that they can build on the map and their ability to try to focus all their tourism in their main capital city, that does twist the new culture game in interesting new directions that we thought also was sort of representative of kind of the role France plays in the world today.
Gotcha. And were there any others that you looked at and thought about maybe changing that, you know, and didn't end up getting changed?
There was nothing that we made as dramatic a change on. There were other places where we had buildings and improvements that gave you quote-unquote tourism. But before, Brave New World tourism was just like extra gold. So we took that extra gold away and transformed it directly into tourism, those kind of changes. So we did go through all the other civilizations and sort of shake out whether or not there were things that just had to be replaced, reshuffled. But nobody got a complete overhaul like France.
So as kind of a follow-up to that question, I'm sure a lot of people are interested. What now that we've got, you know, basically the full roster, we've got 2 expansions out and a whole bunch of DLC, what are the civs that almost made it into Civ 5 that just didn't quite make the cut?
Well, then we have the story about the Pueblo, who we wanted to include. They were the precursor to the Shoshone. But we actually could not get any Pueblo speakers who were interested in speaking in the native dialect. They were worried about our portrayal of their leader in a video game. So we treated that very seriously and were sensitive to that desire on their part and switched over to the Shoshone. So the Pueblo were definitely one. We thought they would have a very interesting, very sort of peaceful, passive, but very resistant to outside influences. You know, that was what their play style was going to be, and it was a little bit unfortunate we couldn't go that way, because it would have made for an interesting tip.
In terms of some of the other ones that didn't make the cut, that's a tough one, because I don't know if I remember any specific off the top of my head when we were whittling down the list. I mean, there's always some of the candidates that come up, like Congo, and the Khmer was one that we...
Yeah, the Khmers didn't make it in because we'd already done Siam, and we felt that was the Indonesia or the Khmer right. to go in, but that the Indonesians were sort of more unique and sort of a more fast-growing, influential country at the moment. We also looked at a sort of swath of countries that used to be colonial powers. So we looked at sort of Brazil, Argentina, Australia, Canada as sort of a collection, South Africa. And we looked at maybe that whole collection and decided we definitely wanted to do one of those powers, but probably not 2 in the same expansion. And Brazil just won out clearly as sort of the up-and-coming member of that group with the world in the next couple of years.
And it gave us a good excuse to have a civ that was really tied into the new tourism culture mechanics, too.
Gotcha. So, of all of the improvements that you've made to the overall flow and gameplay with Brave New World, what do you think you did the best job on? As far as, you know, something that was maybe an annoyance with Gods and Kings that, you know, is no longer the case, or something that just works better overall.
Most of the stuff that we really wanted to add in was all the new material. My own personal one is just the culture overhaul, because I'm a traditionally culture player, especially back through Civ 4 into Civ 5. The problem was in Civ 5 is that the culture game, I mean, after the games, we've had the game out now for 3 years now, from the vanilla version and into Gods and Kings. But somebody who likes to play the culture game after 2.5-3 years, it would put you to sleep, because at a certain point in the game, you're just still doing the same stuff. You're still researching those 5 trees, and towards the end of the game, that can get really, really tiresome. I love Ed's new tourism mechanic much better, the way he overhauled culture, and you're creating now great works of music, great works of art that come up on the screen. You can interact with them, you trade them, and that game actually now ramps up in the end of the game, and it's an active battle with your culture. So if you're the tourism player, you're actively battling against the culture of other civs. If you're trying to stop another civ from getting a tourism victory, you have to choose to ramp up your own culture. It's so many new options now that you have in that late game as a builder type player that don't necessarily revolve around you invading somebody. I think that's what the big win of this scenario is. You've got all these alternatives now to really stop somebody else's march to power in different and really cool ways.
And I think if I was going to add one thing that I, you know, sort of makes me smile when I play the game, is that I'm a big fan of the archaeology system, just because I think it's really exciting to have events that you can remember from earlier in your game, like you wiped out a barbarian camp, or someone came in and attacked and you had a battle, and there's an ancient battlefield that has left ruins on the map on the borders of your civilization. Just having those things reemerge later in the game, once you get to archaeology and you're sending your archaeologists out to investigate the antiquity sites that they're finding, you know, and there's that moment where they finally finish digging at that site and they know what happened there, and you get told about that, and you can decide whether to create a cultural landmark there, whether or not maybe you're just going to take some of the artifacts back to your museum. But just the kind of remembrances of what happened probably 4, 5, 6 hours earlier in your game, it's just sort of a neat moment that I love.
I also have to throw this one out there that's, we haven't talked about much at all, but they've done a tremendous amount of multiplayer improvements, and that's not just going to be in Brave New World. It's going to be patched into all versions of the game when Brave New World comes out, including just the little things, like the ability of all the players to be able to play custom maps, things like that. Our multiplayer team has done wonderful, beautiful things and making it all a lot smoother and improving all of the AI throughout. Just, it's going to be a new experience for multiplayer players.
Excellent. Yeah, I was, when you were bringing up archaeology, it actually brought to mind one of the games I played in the press version. I ended up finding an archaeology site on a new continent from a civilization that didn't exist anymore, which I thought was kind of a cool moment, like actually discovering a lost civilization that had been wiped out, I don't know, 100 turns before I got there or something like that.
No, I just said that's cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. So one of the other big changes you guys have made is the new way the ideology system works, where it kind of, you know, branches out of the culture tree and you choose what you want to slot in there as your final policy tree with order, freedom, and autocracy. I'm curious how that design came about, you know, where it's kind of its own thing. It's still technically tied to culture. Just the way you sort of hybridized breaking it out without, you know, totally making it its own mechanic.
Well, it's interesting because those 3 trees existed all the way back in the original Civ 5. But each time we've added an expansion, we've done a little bit more with them. In Gods and Kings, the trees pretty much, they were strengthened, so they became more important. And the other thing that we did with them was the choice of which of those 3 final policy trees you chose had diplomatic implications, so that everyone who chose freedom sort of naturally grouped together, everyone who chose order or autocracy, that sort of formed into 3 coalitions. And we found that the more we played Gods and Kings, that was a very interesting dynamic, but that, you know, maybe there wasn't as much of a flavor of playing as an order civ or as a freedom civ as we would have liked. So what we ended up doing is sort of just expanding on that concept one more time with Brave New World. It was also sort of what led us, that the implementation of the ideology system got us sort of into that 1920s, 1930s mindset, and that's what led us to picking Brave New World as the title for the expansion. But we decided that we wanted people to really feel like they were playing as a communist civ that was trying to dominate the world by creating this workers' paradise that all the workers of the world could unite behind. And that was actually sort of an amazing kind of role-playing aspect that we could introduce into the game, that you sort of want to adopt that mantle and take your civilization and lead them in that direction and get all the other civilizations in the game to buy into that. The other thing it allowed us to do was it gave tourism a role besides just going for the culture victory. Tourism now is sort of also representing the attractiveness of your people's way of life to the rest of the world. And so if you think about the attempts of Voice of America and Radio Free Europe and some of those other things that the Western world did to try to make sure that their message got into the, past the Iron Curtain and into the Soviet bloc, you can actually do that in the game now. You can set up broadcast towers and you can adopt the right policies within the Freedom Tree and get that message out that way. Or you can fight back against the communist power and trying to make your workers the happiest workers in the world. And that will make other workers in the world think that maybe your path is the right way. So we have all that tension in the game. We really had a goal of trying to make the late game a lot more interesting. And so just building up these ideologies and making them into sort of customizable social policy trees that are much more powerful than the existing ones and have some of this kind of role-playing political aspects to it. It just all felt very good, and we're very happy how that came out.
Awesome. So just, kind of to wind down here, what are each of your favorite new civs to play in the new expansion? Why do you like them so much?
Well, surprisingly enough, mine is Morocco, which is why you ended up playing Morocco in the press preview build. I've played with them a lot just because I like the balance between their little bit of a culture bonus they get and the trade route bonus. And I love the Kazpa. If you got the right start, has a lot of desert in the area. I just love how powerful that becomes later in the game. But that's mine.
I'm not really sold on one over the other, but I have to say, every time I start a game with Venice, I just love it because I've played a lot of games of Civ 5 by now, and that's the one civilization that really makes me feel like I'm playing sort of a whole other game, that it's very different. The game's sort of been turned on its head, and I have to rearrange my whole way of thinking, and my normal progressions of the game gets entirely shifted on me. And that's just really refreshing. So I'm really excited about Venice.
All right.
Sounded like you said you were excited about Dennis. I appreciate that.
We're all very excited about Dennis. So looking back on the whole Civ 5 process and, from the base game through all the expansions, what do you guys see are your big takeaways from that as game designers? Like if you were going to start hypothetically on Civ 6 tomorrow, what would you have taken from, just how the game has evolved?
Oh, gosh.
I have one answer for that, at least, and it sort of builds on what we've been talking about here, is we spent a lot of time looking at the fan community. That's sort of how we got some of the inputs for which civilizations to include or which ones they might be excited about for Brave New World. And one of the threads that we've seen go up in one of the communities recently is a thread discussing what is your go-to civilization, basically your civilization that is your most comfortable one that sort of matches your play style. What's the one that you just sort of naturally gravitate to whenever you're starting up a game? And we've been really, really happy reading that thread, that the results are scattered all the way across the board. We have 34 civilizations that are out there in the world, 9 more coming with Brave New World, and the fact that we've been able to come up with sort of unique play niches and play styles for each of them that appeal to just a wide variety of gamers, I'm really very happy with that, and that's something that I think we definitely need to want to build on from here is just like Venice is really pushing the unique play style, that's something that just brings a lot of replayability and a lot of people coming back to the game because they enjoy trying it with sort of a whole new style each time.
And I'll approach the question from a more of a production point of view. And it's something that that happens just about with every Civ release, and that's to make sure that we continue to pay just as much attention to the end of the game as we pay attention to the beginning of the game, because it's an easy trap to fall into when you're making a new version of Civ, to get excited about this whole new experience you're making, and you end up having all of your experience in the first half of the game, and then the second half ends up being weaker. And that's something I really think that we can learn from.
Gotcha. So is there anything else you guys would like to highlight about Brave New World, especially, you know, things that have not really been in the spotlight with the coverage up till now?
The Scramble for Africa scenario is one of the two scenarios that we've releasing here, and we've managed to sort of hide that under the radar screen. You know, not really talked about it a lot in the press. It's not because we're not excited about it, because it's actually a very, very unique way to play the game. And there are three whole different groupings of powers that each have a different goal within that scenario. So we definitely encourage people to try that out. Some of the scenarios we've put out don't get looked at right away, because people are trying to... There's going to be so much to the base game that has been added that people are going to spend a lot of time with that. But I definitely want to encourage people to try the Scramble for Africa scenario. It's a nice sort of shorter game session. It's not as long as playing a full game, but it's very, very interesting. I've learned a ton of history from it, and it's a very competitive situation, which is a nice challenge in its own right.
And there's a lot of little things that aren't necessarily going to be as documented in terms of just general updates and fixes to existing stuff, to the patch coming for base game and Gods and Kings, AI updates for things that we've found or the fans have identified. There's going to be a lot of that. There's a lot of little UI improvements, just lots of subtlety all over. One of the things that they're going to notice too is even when they're switching back and forth between scenarios, or if they turn off the DLC and play the base game, they're going to see all the original UI load in, so everything is skinnable now. The whole experience has a much higher level of polish than even it did before.
Awesome. And I guess the last thing I've got to ask, are you guys considering this a wrap on Civ 5? Is there any smaller DLC still planned, or is this kind of the capstone of the product?
Well, you never know, honestly. Even when we finished Gods and Kings, we weren't absolutely expecting to do another expansion until we kept playing. We were like, you know what would be awesome for the next thing? And you keep discussing it and new ideas come up. We definitely approached this one as being the one we wanted to kind of wrap up all the loose ends and really make it a complete experience, but you never know. Ed might come in tomorrow and say, but you know what would be really cool? Yeah, and then we'll be at it again. But yeah.
Dinosaurs would be my suggestion. I want playable dinosaurs. I'm sure that's on Steam Workshop somewhere already.
There is a really good mod, actually.
Oh, there's
an ancient era mod, like a pre-ancient era mod that we were playing around with, which is actually pretty neat.
Yeah, I don't know if it has dinosaurs, but it has like discovering fire.
Oh, I think
like
I've
that.
Seen that actually.
It's a mod we've done for sure.
All right, so thanks to Ed and Dennis for talking with us, and we will see you next week on another episode of the PC Gamer Podcast.